workshop. I feel, I know you've had lots of input given to you, so we're really going to workshop this now. So I was just outlining my idea to, Aaron, I didn't get your name, Aaron. What I'm thinking about is that we will do about half our time we'll spend on discussing this settler narratives and responsibility and looking at these questions together. We'll have you in small groups, and if you don't know anything or know very little, I really encourage you also to stay here or be a part of this conversation if you want, because you'll hear other people. So we'll get you in groups of maybe four or five. And so we'll spend half our time on that, and then we'll look at the intergenerational trauma piece, which I actually think we are all carrying some of that. And whether we know that story or not, I'll talk a little bit about the recent research in terms of transmission of trauma across generations, and then we'll open that up for discussion too. So I hope that there's lots of conversation in here together, and anything you want to talk about what I raised up in the session, that is also, we're open to talk about that. So does that sound, we have an hour and a half? Yes.
We have till
12:45, and then we'll break for lunch. So thank you again for joining me here today. And what I really want us to do is, I got a whole almost, 40 minutes to tell you what I'm thinking about settler responsibility and ways to work towards restorative solidarity. And a key piece to that is doing the hard work of uncovering our immigrant history and journey. And again, if you don't know this, this is the time to start imagining where you're going to go to find out this information. It seems that there is a family historian in every family that I have had conversation with. So if you have interest and you don't know, I really encourage you to find out who that is and pay attention to the stories that seem outlandish or, you know, that are strike you as odd, and how they're told when people giggle or their body reactions to stories. Really pay attention to those. What's happening when you're hearing those stories, and what is happening to the person that is telling those stories. And it's just a wonderful journey to go on to understand this. So this is what I would like you to consider. Choose one line of your familial history with which you are familiar and with which you are most interested in. And that tends to be the one that we know the most about. And I want you to try and trace that back to the immigrant generation. And then what I would like us to do is to mark on the map where this line of your people came from and where they landed in the Americas. And again, I know I'm asking, you know, things that you may not know. Wow, I should know this much better. I know, for instance, that my grandparents, I will go maternal because I can see Dnepropetrovsk right there. They were very close to Dnepropetrovsk on the Dnieper River, and they came and they settled in Dundurn, right north of Saskatoon. And so, if those of you, I'd love if all of us could come up here and just draw one of those lines and just say it just like I did. So if you are ready and you know, pop up and let's get these lines on there. One familial line. Oh, and please say when. So mine was, my maternal line actually came at the very end, 1928.
Okay. Amy.
And you can say your name. We'll get to know each other.
Amy, my people fled Alsace, which was a tug-of-war province between France and Germany in, 1860 or something like that? Ridiculous. And before the World War I. And then they settled where other Alsatians were in Washington, Illinois, near Peoria.
And you can draw a line. I like the lines.
Okay.
The
other one.
Other way you like it better.
Thank you.
I'm Brenna. Mm-hmm. My grandmother, my father's mother, left the west coast of Ireland in a small village called Carna, or even smaller, I think it was Bontrapa or something. In the teen, depending on her birth record, which is different, 1909 or 1910, she came in, I think, 1927 to Boston, outside of Boston.
Mike, and in the 1730s, both sides of the family fled southwestern Germany, the fighting between Catholics and Protestants, and came to the banks of the Pulpahocken in southeastern Pennsylvania.
So that's outside of Philadelphia.
My name's Christy, and my paternal grandmother, Jenny van de Woude, moved from the Netherlands with her family. She was a child, and her older sister was going to be a nanny for the children of a widow, a Dutch widow in Montana, and the rest of the family went along, 1908.
Wow. Hi, I'm David.
Let's go red, David.
Way too much about my family history. Not enough, as well. I picked this one because I actually was there where my father's family was from, the Christianstadt, where they talked like Denmark Danish people because they were used to be controlled by the Danish. The Christianstadt is that's way down here, and they moved all the way to Brockton, Massachusetts.
What?
Where they were part of the shoe manufacturing before that got destroyed. So let me see. This is where. Dang.
This is what I always say. I am from Canada. I got no idea. Eastern U.S.
All
right. Brockton's right below Boston.
Yeah, I thought it was just from below Boston. Yeah.
There we go. Good.
What year?
That was in the early 20th century.
I'm Rebecca, and my mother's 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 family is from Pelvorm, which is a tiny island in northern Germany close to Denmark. And her family came over, well, her brothers came first, and then she came over to keep house for her brothers, and then married someone and settled in northwest Iowa.
Now, what I'm going to say, the two of you that are poised and ready to go, that is great. And then we'll get into small groups, and we will have a chance for you to mark your immigrant journey up here if you want to. I wasn't expecting the great crowd, so thank you. It's delightful. Nathan, come on up.
Sure. So my memory actually is much more place-based often. That's
that.
Okay. So I have a lot of, like, names and stories in my head from I went with my family to Sweden, which was where most of my family is from. So I don't remember exact dates, but we'll say my great-grandma Alma, I think came, most of my family came from northern Sweden, so I'll mark that here, and came to, I know at least one member of the family came to Minnesota. I think maybe like kind of central Minnesota.
Thank you.
Font. Yeah.
Awesome.
Oh, in the 1800s.
And Margaret.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
So my, this particular strand of family came from somewhere in Ireland, don't know where, so the ancestor was brought from Ireland as an indentured and enslaved slash indentured servant to Barbados, which is... Barbados.
Woo, good job.
Okay, so brought to Barbados in the early 1600s. And now Las Barbados, there you go. Okay. And then he was sold to a family in the Boston area. And then he kind of fooled around with the daughter of that family and became a part of that family and then part of the early Puritan communities in Massachusetts in the
1600s. Wow. Everybody wants to be in Margaret's group. Yes, oh, absolutely.
There's no one from Asia here. I'll just, so due to time, I'll just make it brief. 5,000 years ago, in 1975, my family went from Seoul to Ellis Island in the west called LAX. So we didn't go this way, but anyway. And then 5 months later, on October 31st, we went to Columbia, South Carolina, where my aunt already was, and it was I thought it was a scary place, but that was because it was Halloween.
Thank you. That just gives us a little bit of flavor of who is in this room, and what I really do, you got a lot of information put at you this morning, so I would like us to gather. Maybe we should even gather in groups of six. I hope that's a reasonable group number. Let's do it. Let's gather in groups of six, and I invite you to talk through these questions, and then we'll have a report out and have a large discussion. So five or six. See what feels good. Cluster together. Five or six. Then, again, make sure you only pick one line of your familial history, because some of us that know a lot can talk for a long time, and I want you to be very conscious of who is in your group, and so that you all get enough time. Please talk about the push and pull factors. I spoke about them this morning. War, economics, political factors. What were the things that pushed your family out? What were things that pulled your family to a location? Push and or pull. Bob, I'm glad you are with us, because is it Bill? I'm so sorry. Bill, I'm glad you're with us, because also you can speak to the push and pull factors. Obviously, you are not coming to America, but you, as an indigenous person, experienced extremely violent pushes. And so these questions also can speak to indigenous people here in North America. So what were the push and pull factors? Who did your family leave behind? Do you know? Did they have any interactions with indigenous people when they got to the Americas? Opportunities and barriers. Did they get land? How did they get land? What were the privileges afforded them? What were the prejudices that they experienced? And then if there is time, to get to cultural losses. And again, some of you will know more than others, but let's take about 20 minutes, which is not tons of time, so be disciplined. So about 3 minutes each. I know, not fair. But we want to have time for group sharing as well. So I will keep letting you know when your minutes are ticking by. Good. Don't forget to introduce yourselves. Name first.
I'm just not wasting time. My name is Solveig. My grandmother was born in Norway, in the mountains, and she, with her family, at the age of 6.
Okay, let's bring our discussion together. Thank you. And you'll don't completely go back because we'll do a little bit more in a moment. But yes, make yourself comfortable. I am curious what it felt like to engage that story. What did it evoke in you as you were trying to answer these questions?
It feels very different than when I address these types of questions with my father, with the family line that I was just speaking about. It's a very different environment. Yeah. The tone that I use here, I'm able to express some frustration and some shame, and I can't express especially that shame.
Yeah.
And I know shame is not, maybe a productive way to feel, so I don't, but I mean, like, I have benefited directly because of my family's history, and I'm not proud of having benefited in that fashion. When I speak to my father and my family about it, to imply or say that we have benefited from the Homestead Act policy, for example, to say that, I get a response, I can feel it from my family of like, you think anything was handed to us?
Yeah, exactly.
Blood, sweat, and tears.
Yeah.
And now, because of your ancestors' blood, sweat, and tears, and hard life, you little smartass have been able to go to college and get all smart, and
right.
Now you're liberal.
Right. Absolutely.
Need to get you back out in the field.
Yeah, exactly, to get some blood, sweat, and tears going again.
So this type of group, this type of conversation it just feels good to be able to say this in a space where I know I can say it and be supported and not criticized for that.
One of the difficult conversations that I had was about the farm subsidies. I have many, many farmers in my family. And just trying to crack open a little bit, yes, farming is hard, but so is hunting and trapping and living off the land. We've been subsidized, for so many years, just even trying to crack that the hard work, that was happening before we came was equally as hard, maybe more hard, and there were no subsidies there for us to, And one of the difficult pieces that came out was the realization, one of my research participants named it, that we have benefited for 150 years living on stolen land and indigenous people, particularly landless bands, have been disenfranchised. That just makes it even more difficult. But raising those with my agribusiness farm cousins, wow, that's tough. Others, what came up?
From, like, just not knowing, but feeling.
Yeah.
Feeling in my bones that, like, there's a perpetrator history there, and an entitled history there, but also a deeply victimized history there. So grief and curiosity to put actual reality to what I feel so deeply.
Yeah. And this question is partly to help us. I think we so think we can think our way out of our predicaments. And so I partly am inviting us to do something that I certainly wasn't raised to do. You know, I was raised, this is where we spend all our time and creative energy and being smart and, you know, wasn't allowed to feel anything. So that's part of my question. Yeah.
When you talk about linear, I remember that I was, because I was educated in a public school system, when they mentioned that we were nomadic, I took that as a negative. Mm-hmm. And but now I understand that we're not linear. Circular.
Yes.
And so, because of that, I know that we went where God provided for us. Mm-hmm. And that was in different areas of the land. And so that's what we did. Mm-hmm. We all did here on Turtle Island. You know, wherever you were, wherever God put you, you know, that there were, that was there. You fit in to there. And that's where our language is. It's in our natural environment. And so one of the things that happened was we needed to be separated from our language and our land. And what did they say? They said, kill the Indian and save the man. And so that worked very well on our people. So I know that saying, pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of understanding here that needs to be out to the rest of the population. Maybe the role, we need to get, we all need to get back in touch with this, that, what God put us where we are. Need to fit into the to Mother Earth. Mm-hmm. It's the same difference between linear and circular.
Yes, yes. And then being pushed off your land and disconnected from that place would have been, I can't imagine the disruption.
It's not pushed or pulled, but I really think it's ethnic cleansing or extermination. You talk about reservations. Reservations are prisoners. It's a prison. So still today, I'm a prisoner of war. So I recognize and I understand that Black Lives Matter. They do. It's real specific. People try to co-opt that and say all lives matter,
yeah.
But still, we need to listen to people who are being oppressed and killed off. And legally, and that's done legally. So I think it's a good place to be here to hear each other's stories.
What are your questions? What are things you want to know more of? Did you think you know, or you knew more than you actually did, and when you started talking you realized, I actually don't know that much? Or did you realize, hey, I know some stuff? What are the other questions that are bubbling up that you want to know more about?
Yeah. I find myself just, as we grow older, we hear more stories, and as we study, as students, we learn more about history, and hearing from individual stories about the history that propelled certain groups certain ways, a lot of those stories
weren't told in a public context.
Right.
And Mike sharing about a bunch of German peasants going and living around London in tents and then getting sent to the United States between different tribes to settle. And, you know, I never heard that part before.
Yeah,
it makes me
right.
so curious about all the social dynamics.
Yeah.
You know, as a sociologist, I suppose, I get curious that direction.
And I think very, very few of us came to America without some sort of, people don't leave voluntarily. If life is well, most people, and we are satisfied and rooted in our place, you know, just even hearing the refugees from Syria, they don't want to go, even with the horror that's happening there. We, most of us, and I, you know, there were a few elites, I think, that were moving around, looking for wealth, opportunity, but they could go back because they were elites. And if it didn't work out here, they'd just go back. But the majority of us came under duress. And that is a piece that I want to look at next. But I want to make sure any other bubblings, I also want to move on to this intergenerational trauma. Yeah. Logan.
I've shared this with our group a little bit. As a white queer person, I notice in myself and in many other, but specifically white queer people I know, a disconnect from family legacy and cultural capital.
Yes.
So even if you're rebuilding or remending your relationship with your family, the inability to find a reflection or to find a place to connect.
Yeah.
I know so many white queer people who are doing anti-racism work and are doing like work about settler colonialism, and I recognize it in myself too, this feeling of palpable grief, and like there is a perpetrator culture, but you don't really know even how to trace it back, and the history is lost to you. And then so many of us are displaced geographically, looking for an extended kinship model of community, trying to find that family again, but we don't know how.
One question that's come to mind is, okay, let's continue, let's ask them more questions, let's get involved. And as a person with the Mennonite migration, sometimes that looks like uniquely dangerous in that it's a hard conversation, but it's a conversation that can be perceived as just anger rather than looking into what reparations really look like.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's just a whole conversation of what that really would look like in my migration pattern. I think it's important work, but I think it's very uniquely situated where it can be dangerous. One example is that, it is what it is. I mean, Mennonite Church is taking the Hopi reservation to court after years and years of a mission school there. The MDS unit ended, and so the Mennonite Church wants to make sure there's financial accountability, and the reality is the whole system belongs to the Hopi people, but that's in the Mennonite Weekly View, and to me, I can't be silent about that.
Yeah.
I have to say this is wrong,
yeah.
But at the same time, it's a scenario that developed outside of my particular migration pattern.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to say too, share with my group, when I did a particular migration history in high school. Come from German Mennonites, and during Reformation time, or after there, Napoleon had an army came through Mennonite communities and said, conscript in my army or face consequences. That ripped apart Amish families. Some did, some did. Mm-hmm. And through my research, I found that later, after some of the folks, Amish folks that served in the Point Army came to America, later became Amish bishops, and that was in my lineage. And
yeah.
That continues to speak with me because there's quote unquote a history of persecution, but also a privilege, and it's deeply intertwined.
Yeah, and your shirt already says you're against the next war.
Yes.
So that is a complicated Bishop Amish legacy, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Thank you. Was there one other hand in
that? One of the things that I always struggle with when approaching this is I feel like, well, I know so little about my history, and I struggle that, like, who I am, like, my values, my struggles, there's like a, the United States has such a history of active eugenics, but I also feel like there's kind of like a passive eugenics. Like, I am who I am.
Right.
I know what I know because there was a group of people who made a policy, and there was like an active creating of a population for a very specific purpose. Mm. And I feel like deep confusion and loss and about like who I am, and if I'm like a real person, or if I have actually any right to talk about being in land, because you can create human populations for political means. And I just, in the middle of all of this, especially because I'm just like that, like, white American that's just without anywhere to grab, like, I personally really struggle emotionally with this conversation, but I love it so much. Hearing other people's reality, it makes it, at least I can hear that some people have that, and that's a good thing. And I just wanted to share that disconnect, but gratitude.
Let's go one more comment, and then we'll talk about a little trauma, and then we'll open it up again.
I just wanted to identify something you said that really connected for where I am right now, like when you were talking about it was only members of elite who could, like, go out and explore things, and if it didn't work out, come back. And I really feel like I'm in that place right now. Because when I, like, I have the privilege of, when I encounter something that's traumatic, when I encounter something that's harmful for me or that I need to unpack, I can take time off. I'm on, like, an unpaid leave right now from teaching for a year, living in a Catholic worker community near my family. Like, there's so many things to catch me if I fall. Mm-hmm. And when I speak with my friends who don't have those families to go back to, or have families who are working 60 hours a week, like, they don't have those options. Mm-hmm. Like, I am the elite. So that just, it's hard to sit with.
Yeah, thank you. I did want to ask, before we left this, do any of you have stories of your first immigrants encountering or in relationship with Indigenous people? Does anybody know that story? You do.
I shared it. Yeah, Maggie. My family, so it's to my matriarchal line, from Norway, settled, homesteaded in central Minnesota, and some trauma there. Lost the grandfather, my grandmother's grandfather, lost his first wife, and I think a couple of kids, and then remarried to this large family, homesteaded land, Indigenous land. And there were other homesteads around, but the narrative that I heard once interviewing my grandmother was that our family survived interactions with Indigenous people, Native people, because that great-great-grandfather knew how to distill liquor and traded with.
That's a hard piece. And that's what you got handed down, and that's the hard work of revising that divisive, you know.
And that's all I know. And that's from an interview in high school that I did before I had any kind of consciousness, before I had encountered myself and people and this story history of alcohol. And so, and you know, they asked me, my group asked me after, you know, how is that story told? And how our stories are told, the tone of those stories, of survival, we survived because of this, and the awkward humor underlying that.
Thank you for sharing that, because we have, many of us have, we have inherited either as family lore or as, you know, communal narratives, these myths and untruths. And exactly as you name, when you're a kid and you've been raised in this culture of whiteness or, you know, however that is defined, we, you know, we don't have the tools yet to question, but sometimes we feel, that feels really yucky, you know, and then as an adult realize, boy, you got to unlodge that narrative out of what was given to you and as a child. This ties well with this, with what's happening in the intergenerational trauma field. So let me just give a little bit of information there, and then we can open the conversation up again. Two researchers studying transmission of trauma write these words. The rememberers are those who have the traumatic event registered in their consciousness without actually having experienced it themselves. The second circle of witnesses to the violent experience. For me, I just feel like that is so true because I heard the stories of my grandparents. I actually didn't for a long time. They were very silent. But I knew something had gone crazy. I knew that my grandparents had gone, all four of them had gone through something awful. But as a kid, you know, you'd walk in the room, they'd be speaking in German. I could understand German because I was raised to speak German, and then they'd change the subject. Or they'd go into Low German, which they never taught us kids, because that's how they communicated. But things would just go silent. Some of the folks that were part of my research, there's two things we do with trauma or violent experiences, violent stories. We either completely silence and suppress them, or we talk about them ad nauseum. And so what this relatively new study of intergenerational transmission of trauma is being done in all sorts of different communities. The research I looked at primarily was descendants of Holocaust survivors, the Armenian genocide, and then in the Canadian Indigenous community. And so I'll just read some of this. These studies found that trauma is passed down biologically, epigenetically, through family systems, and through communal narratives. And this morning, you know, we spoke a lot about communal narratives. The phenomenon has been documented in a wide range of cultural groups and communities who've experienced war, genocide, slavery, and other political oppressions. So in intergenerational trauma is transmitted both through nurture and nature. The word trauma is used fairly frequently now. In everyday language, we throw that word around very loosely. So I want to define my, you know, understanding of trauma for our time together. Oh, about to sneeze. Nope. A traumatic event is described by the American Psychiatric Association as a non-ordinary human experience consisting of serious harm or threat to oneself or relatives. Trauma often has a life beyond the initial experience. Trauma caused by intensely personal violations, such as sexual assault, torture, slavery, or military combat, is the most difficult to recover from compared to, for example, a trauma response to a natural disaster. A significant factor in intergenerational transmission of trauma is post-traumatic stress disorder. This was very interesting to me. PTSD was only discovered in the late 1980s. People used to think that a violent experience would happen to somebody, but as soon as they got out of that experience, they would be fine. And so in the late 1980s, they developed this concept of PTSD. So it describes a syndrome in which a trauma survivor is unable to get the violent events out of their minds. Survivors are haunted by scenes of the violation in nightmares or flashbacks and experience panic attacks, heart palpitations, or severe physiological disturbances. My grandma Ence saw soldiers hold a gun to her husband's head on three different occasions. I don't know if she herself was raped, because there has been such significant silence around gendered violence in our community. But in her later years, when she was in her early 80s, after Grandpa had died, she struggled with hallucinations and believed there were Russian soldiers sitting in her living room threatening to take her back to Russia. And she also imagined phone calls in the middle of the night where soldiers were telling her they were coming to get her. My cousin would spend the night with Grandma, and my grandmother, you know, I'll never forget, you all have these stories, but she had long, long, long silver hair that came down to a braid, down to a point in her back, and it was always, of course, coiled on her head until she was getting ready for bed. And my cousin stayed with her during this time, and my grandma would be so angry with her in the morning because she didn't answer the phone. And so my grandmother had to deal with those Russians, and my cousin said, "Grandma, the phone didn't ring," but she did not believe that. So how did this violence that my grandmother experienced get passed down to my father and his siblings and then to me? So IGT is intergenerational trauma, and it can be transmitted through these ways. One, through family systems. Researchers found that offspring of Holocaust survivors were, in fact, more vulnerable to developing PTSD just by witnessing their parents' chronic PTSD. And some descendants experience PTSD symptoms just from hearing about Holocaust-related events. So I wonder again, my father and his siblings, what was the impact? What did they inherit from my grandmother's PTSD? Other studies looked at parenting styles, communication, and suppressed emotions in family systems. For example, one study showed that survivors of the Khmer Rouge killing fields in Cambodia typically used role-reversing parenting. And that's when a parent looks to a child to meet the parent's needs of intimacy, comfort, or play, and the child attempts to meet those needs. This type of parenting often led to anxiety in that children generation. A study, again, on my Mennonite community describes how Mennonite women who survived Stalinist Russia. So my grandparents got out in the 1920s. There were a whole bunch of Mennonites that did not get out, and they lived through Stalin's pogroms and enforced famines and all that. They often withheld compassion and rejected their children because they were not sure that their children would survive famine, war, or the long trek out of Russia. So the healing for that community is also huge. A study of Kosovar survivors of war and ethnic cleansing found that the children's depressive symptoms were also, or were significantly related to their father's struggles with PTSD. A lot of study has been done on mothers. It's also now that fathers pass down, can pass down PTSD. Dr. Rachel Lev-Wiesel, a researcher, claims that trauma gets passed down as a family legacy whether or not survivors speak about it. And most of my research subjects said they wanted to know more about their parents or grandparents went through, but a few described how their parents talked about the violence ad nauseum. So, a colleague of mine, Harley Eagle, has done research on settler trauma, and I can hardly wait. Wow, that sounds far too excited, sorry. But I look so forward to talking with him, because he, you know, is raising the question, what happened to Europeans that they could come to this land and enslave so many people, participate, and then the genocide of indigenous people here? What went so crazy for those settlers that they were so participatory, or, you know, at best turned a blind eye? So really, what confused some of the research participants that I worked with when we talked about this was that it made it so broad. If everybody's got trauma, how can we possibly work on this? But I want to put that out there, and next time I see you, I will have Harley's research to be able to talk out of. But he talks about Europeans going through the, as Jin talked about, the wars, so many wars that we just brought our unhealed, unawareness of trauma and inflicted it on Turtle Island and all those who were here. Epigenetics is a relatively new field of study, and this supports what Harley is talking about, that looks at inherited changes in gene function. So survivors of life-threatening experiences such as war, torture, slavery, famine, can develop changes to the chemical coding of their chromosomes, though not its structure. So the DNA structure doesn't change, but a chemical coding can go around the DNA, and that is passed down. It becomes a sort of cell memory, and then, like other genetic characteristics, is passed down intergenerationally. And so progeny then thus can carry a kind of physiological footprint of the trauma. Lastly, other studies reveal that trauma effects can be transmitted through biology. And the one study, you know, that really is something we will all be familiar with, a study so it can be passed down to children in utero. A study was done on expectant mothers who were exposed to the World Trade Center attacks in September 2001. And these mothers were in their third trimester during 9/11, and as a result of witnessing the collapse of the towers and the subsequent events, developed PTSD. And then they were found to have lower cortisol levels, and in turn, their babies, who were in utero during 9/11, when they were born, they also showed lower cortisol levels in their first years of life. I am not a biologist. Go.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what are cortisol levels?
Here we go. I'm going to try and go there.
Okay.
I could try, but I'm not.
Right,
what I know...
Stress hormones.
Yeah.
Stress hormones.
Cortisol, when you have a fight or flight, cortisol is part of what shoots through your body to help you... Yeah, it was Jin that was talking about it last night.
Yeah.
You forget about bodily functions, he was saying, and you move into your
survival
mode, thank you, to either fight or flee. Although there's, and some of you will know this, there's a whole
piece of freezing as well that also traps that energy and supposedly leads to PTSD. What is significant about cortisol is we need cortisol, and we need healthy levels of cortisol. Part of our problem is that we don't have, like Jin was saying last night, we don't have those situations of fight and flight like we used to. And he was suggesting that many of us, particularly white folks, are living kind of in a constant state of hyper-arousal. And so when your cortisol levels get whacked up, you are more susceptible to developing PTSD to your own experiences of violence. And that's what was happening. That is what they are thinking is happening with these children. Because these children were born with lower cortisol levels, which impacts your whole physiological system. I'm not a biologist, but that's what I understand. And then the communal narratives. One of the pieces that I didn't speak to this morning, collective experiences of trauma have adverse consequences that are communal, long-lasting, and cross-generational. In the research with my community, there were silences about gendered violence that almost no one in the community talked about. Some survivors talked or wrote about murder, disappearance of loved ones, starvation, home invasions, but very few spoke about rape and sexual assault. And it was ubiquitous. It was used as a tool of war, and many women and girls were raped. But survivors made generalized statements like, all the girls and women over 12-year-old were raped. Or they would speak about rape or sexual assault in the third person. It was very interesting that Marlene Epp did research on Mennonite women, and she interviewed these women, and they would be talking about they were there, they were a part of it, you know, we were being chased. This story was happening, and then all of a sudden they would switch to the third person to describe the rape, and then they would be back in first person again. So she was very helpful for me. If any of you are interested in learning more about that, she's done some really incredible work. Many acknowledged that rape was a very common occurrence, but no one told their children or researchers that they had been raped. So I keep looking at that clock, and it really messes me up.
It's 12:30.
It's 12:30. Thank you. So I want you to gather again, and just for a few minutes, to reflect on the silences in your community's narrative. And we've mentioned some of them, but what are the painful pieces that have been suppressed? What were taboo to talk about? What were the silences that created vacuums that people then filled in with stories? I do want us to, and you know, again, I've worked with groups that have a common migration story. We have a very varied migration story. But have you seen things in your own family system that could attribute to intergenerational PTSD from that migration story? What stories did your church or your family or your local neighborhood pass on about A, being a settler, or about violence? And how was trauma encoded in these stories? So just a few minutes to think together, and then we'll come back together for general discussion. Does that make sense? And I know I rattled a lot of questions out there, and whatever touches you, you can speak to. Thank you. I found this conversation particularly hard to interrupt.
sometimes it's hard to bring these conversations to a close. Are there any ahas or things you want to share out of your conversation? Yeah.
Well, I think that we just had a little bit of an aha here when Mike was sharing just about, you know, and I don't know if it's okay if I say this here, but he was just talking about how folks in his family don't want to share the stories
yeah.
of trauma.
Yeah.
And it's partly to protect.
Oh, yes.
But if this research that you shared with us is correct, whether it's spoken or unspoken, it gets passed on.
It gets passed on.
Right. And so maybe that's a way to open up those conversations, to share with those family members that, you know, this is affecting us whether we tell it or not. Let's hear the story.
Yeah.
Let's talk about it. Let's try to heal.
Yes. And I really think, I mean, I think there's two things going on. And this has challenged me in my restorative justice work because, you know, yeah, Jin, that was 26 years ago that I started, and we just firmly believed that both victims and offenders had to tell their story and had to get it out. And, you know, some of the victims of severe violence that I have been able to work with talk about, you have to get that story out, or it festers within. But I think there's also another piece that in, like, we have to be careful. There is a potential experience of re-victimization in telling that story. So I think, you know, I, even just thinking of difficult conflict, you know, that you've had with a good friend and that has not been reconciled, I don't want to talk about that. That just hurts too much. Well, that is not anywhere near the trauma that we're talking about. So I think there's a protection factor,
self-protection,
and then absolutely protecting our family members. But then, you know, this Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada, that was extraordinarily powerful to witness. And again, this Judge Murray Sinclair, the chair, you know, so encouraged his fellow Indigenous brothers and sisters to come and tell your story and, you know, begin the healing and, you know, yeah, let Canada know what you went through. And then, you know, he said, and you, you know, who are witnessing, do not think that these tears are a sign of weakness. They are about courage. And you have to sit and hear this pain. So, I don't know. Everything I know tells me that we need to tell those stories. And in that TRC, I do believe the way Justice Sinclair was both so pastoral and so prophetic in setting a place of safety for people to share their stories, that I don't doubt. But I know that we have to be really careful when we ask victims to tell their stories.
That makes me hesitate, actually, in going to my family, because I'm now thinking about the disposition I must have in order to ask those questions. So far, it's been about my own healing.
Yeah.
So far, it's been about, you know, I do this anti-racism work or whatever the case might be, and I'm perceived to be sitting in a place of self-righteousness
right.
and judgment.
Yeah.
That if I go looking like I'm digging for something rather than prepared to actually care and heal and receive my parents or my grandparents as if they are also my children, if I don't feel the strength to be able to do that, or if I'm not prepared to actually reconcile, like I have to be honest, that if I hear my father's trauma story for real, then I might actually have to let go of my own. And forgive. So, I don't know, I'm really in a place of tension with that right now.
Thank you for courageously naming that.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I was so focused, I forgot what I was going to say. I feel sometimes like, I know when I started a personal journey because I wanted to be free of like X, Y, and Z pain because it hurt for me. And even to be able to say that was like a journey to get there. And it was just for myself. And I feel like I'm coming to the conclusion that like sometimes pain is just like my personal pain. Like if I really understand how it's been woven through history, I can become strong enough to hold it without like that being the goal. Because like I have a deeper love, I don't know what then the goal becomes. But like now I feel like I want to be a stronger person and like to hold that pain well, just to honor my ancestors well, whoever they were, because they're all faceless to me. And I feel so much like confusion and tension in this, but I used to work at this church, and I still do, but I started a month ago working in the hospital as a chaplain. And it's amazing, you see people's faces, like, it's so easy to see generations of pain, and you have like 20 minutes, and it's like generations of pain, so just over and over again. And this is so deep and so real in everybody. And I don't know what to do with that, except that we have to become stronger somehow. But so I need to tell us.
Yeah. Hey, I've already kept you 5 minutes over time, so thank you. Thank you very much for your wrestling. And I look forward to our continued conversation, because as disciples, we need to figure this work out and figure out how we are going to be rooted in our watershed and know those stories and love our people, who all of our people who are a part of that watershed, and we need to do the work around that. Thank you, friends. Thank you. Have a good lunch.